Before we begin, we'd just like to remind everyone, if they have a cell phone, to please turn it off. Cell phone, please turn off. Well, good morning, and welcome to this United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We're in trouble because we don't know where we are. Theosophy, before we do that, our announcements are that we certainly have a Sunday morning class each Sunday at 11 a.m. to 12 noon, and we take up a theosophical subject. During the month of January, it's the path of spiritual evolution, and this morning's talk will be the pivotal point in spiritual progress. And next week is the Pledge of Kuan Yin. Now, in keeping with that, we have a Wednesday evening study class from 7:45 to 9 p.m. And we are presently reviewing together The Ocean of Theosophy. It's a synthesis, which is not possible, but a synthesis of the secret doctrine. But has many of the main ideas that are discussed. Now, we also would like to remind you, because of what we do here, we keep before the public ideas that are the birthright of humanity. So it's a very noble cause. And not to degrade it, we keep these doors open. We keep these activities going on through voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. And it is one way that we become involved in this noble cause. Now, this noble cause is why we are here. This wisdom, this philosophy that's discussed in these rooms is very ancient, and it's the accumulated wisdom of the ages that was passed down from generation to generation, usually verbally, but this knowledge can be found on a few glyphs and symbols found throughout the world. But one must need a key to read them and to understand them. Well, Theosophy provides that key, because it postulates that there is oneness. There is that which is unchanging, absolute, eternal, and boundless. And it is a unity. And that unity is reflected in us. And the realization of that is a truer realization of the self within, and a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. But one cannot understand or attain this without one ingredient. That's individual devotion. Because through no other way will one understand this knowledge. Now, everyone is united here, but on similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. And that embodies these fundamental principles. And Theosophy welcomes everyone to this association who works for humanity. So, this is the basis on which we come here. Now, today's class, like all other classes, are a meditation in progress. These are points of consideration. And we are very fortunate that we can meditate together on these grand and noble ideas. So this morning, we are going to look at one of the great mysteries of mankind, that pivotal doctrine. One of the keys that opens up the door to our understanding of our place in the universe, our reason for being here, and who we are. So this morning we're going to have a presentation of, the title is, The Pivotal Point in Spiritual Progress. And we'll have questions following.
The Pivotal Point in Spiritual Progress. I'd like to open this morning's meeting with a reading from The Secret Doctrine, Volume 2. The breath needed a form. The fathers gave it. The breath needed a gross body. The earth molded it. The breath needed the spirit of life. The Sola Lahaz breathed into its form. The breath needed a mirror of its body. We gave it our own, said the Dhyanis. The breath needed a vehicle of a desire. It has it, said the drainer of waters. But breath needs a mind to embrace the universe. We cannot give it that, said the fathers. I never had it, said the spirit of the earth. The form would be consumed were I to give it mine, said the great fire. Man remained an empty, senseless Buddha. There is no particle of manifestation, neither space or form, from which the monad is absent. The monad being the unity, the one, that immortal part of man. Theosophy teaches that the vital fires are in all things and not an atom is devoid of them. The reason for this is that there can be no evolution without the monad. Involution is first, and then is followed by evolution. For billions of years, the monad was involved in the mineral kingdom, which is the lowest form of matter. Due to the monad's inconceivable fineness, its evolutionary effect is very slow. But through countless eons, the labor continued. First, the mineral kingdom, followed by the vegetable kingdom, and then the animal kingdom. And finally, after many ages, a superior animal body is brought into being. At this pivotal point, progress comes to a standstill. A chasm interrupts the forward movement, a chasm which could not be crossed without the aid of something beside or beyond nature. A weak spark existed in the form, but self-consciousness was absent. Manas the thinker was a mere germ, a latent potential with no way of advancing further, unaided. The superior animal vehicle at this point wasn't uniformly developed. Some were only animals with superior forms. Others had a spark that made them promising, but not fully ready for the next forward thrust of the species. While others were indeed fully ready for the third stream of evolution. The third stream is the intellectual, the power of self-consciousness, and the gift of choice. We have been shown the physical evolution from the mineral kingdom through the vegetable kingdom and up to the animal kingdom, and finally up to the senseless Buddha, or mindless man. During this entire endeavor, the spiritual entities, monads, are encased in physical forms, and it was through them, and only through them, that physical evolution could proceed. As matter became increasingly dense, the monads became more involved in it, and as form ascended, they, the monads, descended, seeking a middle point where spirit and matter might encounter one another. Advanced entities who are known under many titles, including Sons of Wisdom, Fiery Dhyanis, Archangels, and many others, having won self-consciousness in other worlds in former Manvantaras, or great cycles of time, but who still had karmic debts to settle, willingly and courageously submitted to incarnating in these bodies of mindless forms. Now Manas has entered into the evolutionary path, joining the physical and the spiritual streams of evolution. In these shall we dwell, said the fiery Dhyanis, speaking of those who were ready for the next thrust of the species. And so they entered into the prepared forms, filling the gap between the higher and the lower principles of man. Their fiery nature, kindling the germ of Manas in the mindless who were ready, and even by influence lifting those who had but a spark of promise. I'd like to close with a quote from Genesis 3:22. And the Lord God said, behold, the man has become as one of us to know good and evil.
There's a point of view that we don't often get, but it's a view of us in prior times or prior cycles and periods of evolution. Now, I'm sure this has raised some questions. If you want to entertain anything. Yes.
This story, or this idea seems to expand many different cultures and religions, and it's so in-depth, it's so consistent and persistent that you have to, even the most person who is, you know, they have to have some credibility. There's something there that we can't see. Would you go into some of the different religions or cultures that, you know, illustrated this point or the points that were made?
Well, all religions have reflected these ideas in some form or another. These ideas are universal. They're universal ideas. They apply to humanity in its evolution. And it goes to the purpose of us even being here. So in all religions, we have portions of this, you know, talked about and kept secret within the bodies of religion. Reincarnation in Christianity is there, but it is hidden more now than it had been in the past. The idea of karma is present. In Buddhism, all these ideas are expressed in one way or another. You know, the idea of reincarnation, the idea of how the cosmos came into being, how there are gods or spiritual forces of planets and of stars, of nature. I mean, all these ideas of life being more than what we see, that behind it lies a great spirit. And because of how we've been educated, we approach things from how evolution was taught to us, and we see it that way. And it sort of cripples the mind, because we can't toss off those shackles of us coming up from physical matter and into this light, when it is stated that we've come from light into this darkness and back from the darkness into the light again. This is our spiritual evolution. And the mind and the body are just vehicles for the expression of this.
Well, two examples that we can think of that in different philosophies or religions that have to do with the lighting up of the mind would be Prometheus on the one hand and Lucifer on the other. Could we like investigate these two and see where the commonalities are?
Well, it goes back to the ideas, not only in religions that these ideas are found, but in stories and myths. And the story of Prometheus, the bringer of light unto man. He had to steal fire. Well, fire, light. He had to steal it from the gods to give it to man, because the gods were jealous. They did not want man to be greater than them. You know, and that this goes back to the to mind and what mind is. You know, it's the word fires are used to express this light. But the fire is something that consumes, that lights something up. And all of life is fire. We just do not see it that way. And ideas and thought is a fire of its own, a divine fire. And that mind is a universal principle. And so its expression can be found in mostly all myths and legends. It's something that's interesting that when you look at myths and legends, the symbols for our nature are found within these myths and legends. Our desire nature, you know, the breath, you know, the astral, all these are can be seen in myths and legends. But when it comes to mind is the last symbol that is used or can be expressed. Anything higher than that is not expressible in on this plane of realization. You know, that many of the stories of gods and goddesses are about twins or about two people, but it's about mind, higher mind and lower mind. So there's no place, you know, the idea of Lucifer, you know, is an idea of mind being lit up and with the fire of knowledge. And all those myths and legends that are found around it are an expression of peculiarities of man and mind. In the back.
Well, then the pivotal doctrine is our ability to choose good or evil. And therefore, that makes us higher than the gods, because they can only choose to be good. So isn't that the pivot right there, our choice?
That is the key word for today. That is the pivot, and it goes back to the legend of Lucifer, and even of Prometheus. There is when the mind becomes lit, the Garden of Eden, the eating of the apple, man has a choice between good and evil, or between what which is selfish and that which is selfless or unselfish. So choice becomes, which is what makes man a god or as a god.
One of the similarities between the myth of Prometheus and Lucifer in this regard is both characters
either fall or are bound down by material conditions, and as a result, experience tremendous suffering of the passions and the lower aspects of life. How does that fit in with the pivotal doctrine?
Well, it becomes an analogy of man's struggle, Prometheus and Lucifer, because we now have a choice. And it is mind being lit up, which makes of man a moral being. The problem that exists in the world in which we live now is that mind has no expression in this world unless it is solidified in this body, and that is done through the passions and the lower mind, but the passions and mind. Without that individual or that ego or egoic action of this personal nature, one cannot move forward. Because what the mind recognizes of life is often the deprivation that it sees or experiences. And that is what profoundly affects us, because we are not alone, we are not deprived, we are not these bodies, we are mind beings, that we have lit up within us this fire. But this fire lit up all these other fires that exist in the body. You know, of course you see the passions as being a great symbol for passions and desires, but that is a fire. The breath is a fire. The astral body is a fire. And even this physical manifested world are fires, but materialized. You know, they're manifest. So the idea of the pivotal point in evolution is man. For man is given the choice that all these other stages, the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, are leading up to the entrance of mind. Because they said there was a double evolution, spiritual and physical. So we have this happening all at one time, that as spirit descends, matter ascends. Or matter is more informed by the spirit. But the spirit never enters matter. It reflects itself in it. And it cannot really touch it until it has a vehicle to do that. And the mind becomes that vehicle for the expression or the uniting of mind and matter, or spirit and matter. They're two sides of the same coin, but the mind is the bridge between them.
Well, aren't there three streams of evolution? The spiritual, the physical, and the intellectual mind, which you were just speaking of. And in the garden, before eating of the tree of good and evil, fruit of the tree of good and evil, it was really mindless, wasn't it? It was just a childlike, mindless state where anything would have been accepted on face value, but once the fruit was eaten, then the mind came in.
Well, this is why this is independent devotion. Because this idea expands our mind, because it's abstract to us in many ways, that there is a understanding of how we have, first, it's in our talk, it is an involution, then it is evolution. We were mighty and great beings with vast spiritual powers. But we were informed that we're very much more ethereal. And not until we entered the physical form and being trapped in matter and darkness and ignorance can we begin to struggle through self-realization, evolve back into spirit. And what happens when we evolve back into spirit? We affect all of that which we pass through. So we are, in fact, bringing or attracting all these other lives to us and with us on this journey. So, I mean, the symbolism, the allegories that we find in the Bible, or the Garden of Eden, are just that, are allegories for man's evolution, or involution to evolution. And there is a point of understanding what that means, because it instills in our mind the greatness that we are and the potential that we can be, that we are headed in that direction. Now we often see Buddhas or we see Christ. How come they got like that? Where did they come from? What is that all about? Well, genius and perfectibility is what this is all about. And it's not what we're striving for, but this is what happens. And that Christ and Buddha are individuals or individualities that have forced themselves into higher states of consciousness. It's not, they're ahead of the evolutionary track of all of us, but we will experience that. That opportunity will be given to us. We will have choices that we will have to make, whether to continue furthering in evolving or to fall back into darkness.
It's been said that the pivotal point of spiritual evolution begins with free will and choice. But there are so many things in our physical life, in our emotional nature, in the ideas that we hold that seem to inhibit and influence and even prevent the exercise of free will and choice. So can there be some discussion on why choice is really free and is some examples of where it is not influenced by external conditions?
We think we go back to Lucifer here. We go back to these ideas that man's nature is bound down by the darkness, by the ignorance, and therefore that he doesn't have free will. He is born into sin, you know, shackled with the pain and suffering of the world and nothing to do about it because we only live once. And the reality is that we are the opposite, that we are on a journey, and that the only way that we can travel this road or on this path is through will. We have to have the will, but if we don't have the desire, we will never exert the will. So we see in life that which we will to have, we usually get. Maybe not when we want it, but we get it. Well, that's just an inkling of the power that exists when we train our will. We train our concentration. We train our mind so that it is no longer pulled or distracted by that lower mind of, you know, it just sort of flies off sometimes for no reason, or we like something and it goes off to that, we don't like something, it goes off to that, and you know, and we just don't consider anything, which is rather an abnormal state, but those are the tendencies of the lower mind. Well, that is knowledge that can help us to touch that higher mind. And we do that through the training of our desires, where we take our will and we decide we are not we are not, it's not that we are not going to do something, but we are going to do something. It's always positive. We're always going forward. And then we're working with the flow of nature. Because it is never, it's always going forward. Always. And the negativity that we find is created by the ignorance around us. And that's all it is darkness.
Well, perhaps, you know, to some people, they will be very, very convinced that they don't have the free will and they don't have the choice. And perhaps some of those people are the very people who have no idea about the ideas of reincarnation and karma. And so perhaps those who think that they don't have free will and choice, it's really because through free will and choice, they have set up certain conditions that have seemingly taken it away from them. And until they learn the lessons that they should, they're not going to have as wide of an array of free will and choice.
Well, I mean, that is the problem with life. I mean, we live many lives, and we have many tendencies. And we've thought many different ways. But apparently we thought this way in the past, because here we are again. Again, trying to bring this understanding to a clear perspective in this world in which we live. And it comes through desire and will that we do that. Now, we have generations now that no longer feel that they have any control over anything, and especially themselves. So there's no sense of responsibility. And the idea of reincarnation is a very powerful thing, as you suggest, because once one understands that this is not one life, that is many lives, and that we are the fashioners of our lives to be and of the life that we live in through cause and effect. So therefore, we have the ability to make a choice to go in a certain direction. And oftentimes, many do not think they have a choice at all. So they just let life take them. Okay? And we see that. We see people just, how life unfolds in front of them, they flow with it. And sometimes it's fine. You know, their life is pleasant or not too disruptive, but not forever. Every life has its bumps and its perceptions and its lessons to be learned.
Would you say, when you were talking just a little bit earlier about the will to believe, that seems to be related to God, that there actually is ignorance as to whether God exists. There's no proof. Isn't it a will to believe when I talk to a person who believes in God and they're absolutely sure he exists, that's really a statement of ignorance, but using the will to believe because it's important, or they need to believe.
Yes. Well, in the Gita, it calls that faith, that we all have faith. It's inherent in every human being to have faith. We have faith in something. And we find in the world today, and even our own mind, that outside of us lies the answer. We're always searching for this or that, but it's outside of us. Our concentration, our focus is outside of us. So theosophy says that we evolve from within outward. So therefore, God is not out there. God is within us. So that when we meet people who believe or have faith in God, it's not a bad thing. It's just that they do not understand who they are. And when do we understand who we are? Or how do we understand who we are? You know, that we don't look at ourselves unless we have suffered. Or we have some kind of obstacle which we have to overcome, so we must examine the life we are living and say, you know, and try to put life in perspective. But with these basic ideas that are found in theosophy about the oneness of life and the periodicity of life, And this pivotal idea that we have choices, that we are the evolvers of this universe, This, we are fashioning this universe. But we can only do that when? Right now, in the moment we are living, by the choices that we make. Either the choices are very subtle. What do we think about? What gets our attention? You know, we have a feeling that's overcoming us.
Yeah, people who believe in Jesus, they say he's showing me what to do next. It doesn't
yes.
come from them necessarily. It's probably, being an atheist, it seems like an illusion. You're making the decision. You're crediting Jesus to. He's directing you this way, pushing you this way.
Well, this is what religion has done to man. It made him his salvation is outside of himself. Theosophy is saying salvation is within yourself. And the word God, in the mind, it conjures up an anthropomorphic being of some sort. Well, theosophists would use the word God, but only with the understanding that it is a principle. All right? It is not a being, it is be-ness. And from this, everything comes forth. Just as from us, we are the universe. From within us, everything comes forth. And we are the generators of will and desire. But it's something that wells up with inside of us. It's a desire, but it's a desire to know the truth. So you look and you see around you that the ideas that are false that people hold on to and make them true. And so their life is somewhat, we would say, hollow or unjustified, because the truth is, they're not living in the truth. But that doesn't mean that because someone does not live in the truth, they can't be good and caring people. It's that, again, that all human beings are endowed with faith. Okay? That there is faith within all. And it's expressed by the ideas that we have. If we do not believe there's a God, our faith is in that, but it's still faith.
Well, one of the difficulties then, for one who has a tremendous faith or belief in something outside themselves, is that there seem to be things of a very good nature that occur in their lives as the result of that faith and belief. So it's reinforced. But from what's been said, it's not the outside source that's doing it. It's the exercise of the intrinsic faith and power of will of the individual that's bringing it about.
Yes. 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 It is. We are all lights, and the expression of that light is varied through one's understanding of who they are and what their purpose is. So many people are kind and gentle and see the reality that there is a brotherhood in life, that all of nature is working with them in a symphony of sounds and cooperation and sacrifice for us. And people, many are humbled by that. And it does not matter what religion you are, that is a basic understanding of humanity. And that will open the heart. And the mind will slowly answer to those cries of the heart. It does turn within, because suffering does make us look within, for thou art Buddha. Christ is only an analogy for Christos, that light within.
Yeah, well, so perhaps then those who interpret the voice of their conscience or their intuition as a message from Christ, perhaps really what it comes down to is, who cares what they think it is, because if they use this higher positive system of ethics as a basis for their action, and they are serving others in the name of Christ, well, that's how they understand it, and that's their karma in this life. I mean, in the Gita, Krishna has said that, something like, he who is worshiping me in the highest that he can, even if it's a false god, is really worshiping me.
Me, right. Again, it goes back to this idea of faith. It is an attribute of the very beingness of our nature. That we know that there is something higher than where we are right now. And that probably growing up, we've been exposed to religions. And we've been exposed to these erroneous ideas. But we always, the religions could not hide the truth. They tried to, but it couldn't be hidden. Because who is this Jesus? What kind of being is he? How did he become what he was? Where did Buddha come from? What is that an expression of? Was he like me or you? And if that is the case, what is the journey one must travel to be a benefit to humanity? To help those that one loves. Because it's compassion that binds us together in that whole. So that we learn this compassion from birth, from our mother, from our father, from our family, but mostly from our mothers. Because what kind of compassionate being would bring this into the world? And through pain and suffering. So, the heart, that light of the heart is lit up by the mind when it is endowed with compassion.
Well, we've heard, but we just simply cannot imagine that we have come this far. And that we have freedom of choice based on what the preacher says. Other than what the preacher says, rather. Does theosophy give us a key whereby we can get a picture of what is meant by free will and choice?
Yes, it gives a very definite answer to that question. It's called independent devotion. Through looking at an idea and not understanding it and having a question about it, if we do not look and try to discover the truth for ourselves, we will be no better than that person looking to their outside God for an answer. That the answer is within us. And if we do not struggle to find that answer, we'll never find it. Because if this person sitting up here or another volunteer is sitting up here and gives you an answer, that's maybe their answer, but it's not your answer. It is only a answer. And that everything that one hears, one discriminates. True? How does this resonate with me? Does it have any meaning beyond just these words that are being spoken? How can I make it a living power in my life? Is that possible? Can that affect one's life? What kind of powers do we have? I mean, there's many, many questions. So it's like, what difference does it make coming here to these rooms and talking about these ideas? What is the effect? Because there must be effect. And we find that when there's an association, a similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, strength grows. Not only within the individual, within those who are associated together, and discussing these ideas and meditating on these ideas and concentrating on these ideas and trying to expand the mind to make oneself better able to help and teach others.
So symbolically then, in the Garden of Eden, the serpent which whispered in Eve's ear and told her to offer the apple was not only the passing on of this ability to gain knowledge, but as was said earlier, the knowledge of good and evil, which is the essence of free will and choice. Because once we have that power, as was said, it is up to us how we use it for the good or for the evil. But the symbology is right there.
Yeah, but we have that power. That's why we're in the mess that we are. We have that power. We have created this world in which we live. We've created it. We've done it collectively, and we've done it individually. And it radiates in the world in which we live. So the idea of reincarnation and karma, therefore, gives us a point of reference and of understanding and makes us more compassionate for the weaknesses of others. Because we are not so great. We may understand these ideas to some degree, but we are struggling in life like every other being on this plane.
Yeah, it's common. I think the will to be compassionate will always be fighting against the will of the ego I want this for me, for my benefits. And that even compassion can be felt by the ego. The ego can be satisfied because I've done something good for someone. That's the reason I did it.
Yeah.
I think there'll always be that struggle. I don't know if that's the good and evil struggle, ego and compassion or not.
Well, I mean, those ideas are the struggle. The Bhagavad Gita is written about that struggle. The entire book is about that struggle between our higher and our lower self. There is that battle going on. And you see these wars that go on in the world, it's the same thing. But it's an outward expression of an inward struggle. And this is what makes us grow. If we do not struggle with this idea and want to know the truth, we stay wherever we are. It's always a struggle. And that is, you can see that analogy in almost everything.
Do they claim to suppress the ego completely? Buddhists, do they claim to repress the ego completely and not be experiences acting upon them in their only compassion?
This point is one which we all struggle with. Do we look for enlightenment for ourselves? Do we look to escape this plane of suffering for ourselves? And the compassion comes in when we realize that we are a unity. So if my brother or sister is in pain and suffering, I do nothing to alleviate that or to help with that. It does them no good, but it does me no good either, because I cannot really rise above all of that and leave my brother or sister behind. It's that which solidifies the mind and the body together and makes this a pivotal doctrine, is this idea that you're talking about. Is that selfishness, that oneness that we see on the physical plane, must be transcended to that oneness on the spiritual plane. That is the struggle. But it is necessary for one to have that selfishness. Because if you do not have it and understand it, how can you transcend it? How can you become unselfish, let alone selfless? What does that all mean? And yes, the Buddhists make a an attempt to transcend that selfishness to the selflessness. And they have a whole path or journey that one takes. But this is found in all religions, in Christianity, in Mohammedism, you know, Zoroastrianism. I mean, all these religions, there is a path to this all-knowingness, enlightenment. And back.
One of the things that we all observe is the only thing we can choose most of the time is how we're going to feel about what's happening, what's going on. We have no other choice. Well, that turns out to be the pivotal doctrine in the Bhagavad Gita. When Krishna tells Arjuna, he's going to teach him because he's now one who findeth no fault. So once we begin to understand, I made the mess, and change our attitude about it, then we can make other choices.
Well, it's quite poignant that, you know, we can change how we feel about something. And that's the key. Because that interprets every action, how we feel. We don't maybe express it in our mind, but there's a feeling associated with it. And that's why we're asked as students to watch. Watch ourselves. Watch our thoughts. Watch our feelings. Be ever vigilant to our own nature. Because by looking there, we unlock a key. Then we better understand everyone around us, because everyone struggles, not in the same way, but everyone struggles with their personal nature.
The idea of manas, its duality. On one side, it's the animal passions; on the other side, it's the higher self, and the center of it is balanced like a seesaw on a fulcrum of will and desire. Robert Louis Stevenson, in his book Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, dealt with this, and really for popular literature did a great service, because in the character wanted to eradicate the evil, do away with it, had no need for it, and in his attempt to do so he met disaster. Because that balance cannot be maintained with only weight on one side. It has to be balanced. It has to have a counter force in order for it to be balanced. So it's not a bad thing. It is really a just thing.
Well, it's quite interesting that, you know, evil, or that which is bad, it's said in the philosophy, resist it not. Resist it not. It goes back to our feeling nature. Why do we resist something? Because it's not right. It goes against what we believe. It offends us. In some way, it's personalized. We feel a certain way, and therefore, we react. If we do not have any concern about what is taking place, one will not react to it. And that doesn't mean that one does not care, but does not have a concern about its outcome or the effects that it's going to follow. So if there is, how do we balance evil in our life? Can we balance it? Well, it's created by us, because how it comes to us and how we react to it becomes the reality. Because if hatred is shown to us, if we do not counteract it with love, we become that hate. That's the only choice. So that's only through knowledge. If you keep on doing something long enough and you're not paying attention to it, it doesn't matter. But if you pay attention and you see that he hates me, well, I hate him back, well, you know, it doesn't work. It just makes the hatred stronger. So that is a lesson each one must learn for themselves.
And what was just described can only happen when we are truly detached from the situation, and we accomplish that by what we read in the Gita. When we are able to stand as one not affected by pain or pleasure, by honor or disgrace, then we are able to deal with the situation as a situation, as was just described. Here is hate, let me apply love, but without getting involved in it, which is the state of those who have control.
Yeah, it's again about our feeling, our feelings, how our feeling nature is affected by everything that happens to us. And when one begins to recognize, become aware of these many sheaths around us, within us, and affecting us, then we begin to look. That's all, look. You cannot change anything if you don't see it. And it takes a strong soul to look deep within one soul.
In a previous question, the statement was made along the lines that if someone is compassionate towards another, they feel good about it. And it seems to serve some personal gratification because they feel good. Does the joy that we experience from being compassionate, is that from the same source, is of the same nature, that the joy that comes from the gratification of our desires?
Well, it's joy is joy, but there's degrees of everything. You know, that we feel joy in life in the presence of family or friends. You know, but there's a higher kind of joy that's called ecstasy. You know, that the union with God or with that oneness, the lighting up of within ourselves of that reality of what we are, that we make this vehicle a better expression of the higher self. So, you know, this is life. This is what we consider to be real. What we consider to be real is how we live our life. That idea that we have, that it was expressed by a parent, or we picked it up from a teacher, and we've held on to it as the reality, and this is how we see life. Theosophy gives us an opportunity to clear away the clutter of ideas that we have picked up and take for a moment an idea unencumbered by other ideas and look at it solely for what it is. And this is what this unity, this oneness, this is all about, is the understanding of our place in the world. Yes.
Well, today we don't have much time, but today it appears from our experience that you go to the doctors today generally, they'll give you a pill to ease the pain, but they begin to talk to get you to see that the cause has not been taken care of, just the effects. So it seems that they don't call it theosophy. They may call it philosophy or psychology, but they're trying to teach the people to use their imagination and do a little bit of inner thought as to the cause of their pain and suffering. And that's to give them, empowering the people to think for themselves.
Yes. Independent devotion, the consideration of an abstract idea will broaden the mind and give us an opportunity to begin to understand these things which have become a great mystery to us. What we reawaken in ourselves, the truth. So, again, in keeping with these ideas as presented today, all activity at this lodge is carried on through voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. All are welcome to participate. A meeting adjourned.